The Guardian.
Science Weekly is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace's award-winning templates are the most beautiful way to present your ideas online. See for yourself. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GUARDIANSCIENCE to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
NASA has named about 20 spacecraft after distinguished researchers like Hubble, Chandrasekhar, and Fermi. However, NASA has never named a spacecraft after a researcher during their lifetime. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're about to make history.
On the 31st of May, NASA announced that its hotly anticipated solar probe mission was to be renamed in honor of astrophysicist Professor Eugene Parker.
A few days before your 90th birthday, Gene, to announce that we're renaming the Solar Probe Plus spacecraft to be known from now on as the Parker Solar Probe.
It was a world first. No person has ever before had the honor of having a NASA mission named after them whilst they're still alive. The gesture honoured Parker's breakthrough work from the 1950s, which proposed the existence of high-speed solar winds, and his subsequent discoveries.
By heroic, of course, I'm referring to the temperature, the thermal radiation from the sun, and the extreme measures developed to survive that radiation and collect scientific data should be fully appreciated.
But what is this solar wind? And what are spacecraft like the Parker Solar Probe hoping to find out about it?
The devil is always in the details, and so, again, that's why we're going so close. We want to be measuring things as they're first happening, not as they've kind of averaged out and smoothed out 92 million miles away.
And if you think about where we are on the Earth's surface, the unit that we use to measure magnetic field is the Tesla. And on the Earth's surface, it's about 50,000 nanotesla, and we want to measure fields that are around 10 nanotesla. So this is the solar wind field. This is the sun's magnetic field.
I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly. Before we get to the actual spacecraft itself, a bit of background might be useful. And who better to ask than a key member of the Parker Solar Probe team?
Good morning.
Hello, is that Nikki Fox?
Yes, it is.
Hi.
This is Dr. Nikki Fox.
I'm Dr. Nikki Fox. I work at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab in Maryland, USA. And I have the great honor of being the project scientist for NASA's Parker Solar Probe mission.
I spoke to Nikki via Skype this week.
So Nikki, let's talk a bit about the structure of the sun to start with and where the Earth fits in. So you have the sun and you have its atmosphere, and then you have this thing called the heliosphere. Can you talk me through all that?
Yes, certainly. So the sun, as you know, is the center of our solar system, large body, very magnetic, very hot, very dense. 99% of the mass of the solar system is actually in the sun itself. And just above the sun, we see the corona, which is the hazy atmosphere visible during a solar eclipse. This is one of our big mysteries. In this coronal region, instead of it being cooler than the surface of the sun as you move away, it actually gets hotter. So the surface of the sun is just under 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and yet the corona is up at about 2 million degrees, and that just shouldn't happen. So this is one of our first mysteries. In the region where this heating occurs, this solar atmosphere or the coronal region suddenly gets very energized, and it accelerates and takes off and literally moves away from the sun at speeds of about a million miles an hour. Again, that shouldn't really happen. The sun is a huge central body, and you'd think everything would be constrained to that. But no, these processes occur. And that makes this solar material stream away and it bathes all of the planets. And we call this the solar wind. And so that means that all of our planets in our solar system kind of live in the atmosphere of the sun. And what that means is that the solar wind can actually interact with each of the planets. We know, for example, it's stripped away the atmosphere of Mars. Here at the Earth, we seem to be in this perfect location where life can flourish here. And yet we're close enough that if the sun sneezes, the Earth will catch a cold. And so, you know, we all live in this atmosphere of the sun, and we call it the heliosphere, and that's basically as far as the solar wind reaches.
So it would seem that this direct effect on the Earth, along with sheer curiosity, means that probing the sun and its solar wind is a good move. But what else does the Parker Solar Probe, which is scheduled for launch next year, hope to achieve?
So for us, we're really going to kind of fill in the missing piece of you know, our measurements and even the gap in our knowledge. You know, we've known for decades and decades that the corona was hotter than the surface of the sun. That was discovered using spectroscopy. So, you know, you basically look at the fingerprints of what is in the atmosphere. And at the beginning, when they were taking these spectral lines, they didn't match any of the elements here on Earth. And so initially it was thought it was some new element that hadn't been known before. And they actually called it coronium. And then a little while later, people realized, no, it's actually superheated elements. So it's got the same fingerprints as elements that are here at Earth, but just at such a high temperature that a lot of the electrons have been stripped off. So we've known for a long time that this is actually the case, but we've not yet been able to explain why. And the only way that we can really finally solve this puzzle is to go right into the region and actually take samples. You know, we've done a lot by our tremendous cameras and images that we have, you know, looking at the sun in all kinds of different ways. And we have spacecraft that have gone even inside the orbit of Mercury, so they've gone close to the sun. And so we've got, you know, those profiles of what the solar wind looks like into that distance. But magic happens in this region where suddenly the heating occurs and where this acceleration occurs. And we just don't know what these processes are without physically going in and sampling that solar wind.
So the closer we get to this pristine solar wind, the more we can reveal about its nature and its origins.
Hello?
Hello, this is Helen O'Brien. I was trying to talk to Max Sanderson.
Yeah, he's here with me. It's Nicola Davis here from The Guardian.
But like the old saying goes, two minds are better than one.
No problem.
This is Helen O'Brien from Imperial College London.
I'm Helen O'Brien, and I am the instrument manager for the magnetometer, which will fly on the European Space Agency Solar Orbiter satellite.
The mission is scheduled to launch shortly after NASA's Parker Solar Probe. I spoke to Helen via Skype and started by asking her just how these two solar missions are connected.
When it comes to Solar Orbiter and Solar Probe, they're actually very complementary missions. And it's really wonderful that they're happening at the same time because it means that they will be able to work together. And it's great for our understanding of the star and the star system that we live in. But it's also really important that both NASA and the European Space Agency are both focusing funding on this particular area of science at the same time. So when we launch Solar Probe and then afterwards, or the Parker Solar Probe and afterwards Solar Orbiter, we will get two measurement points. Yeah, really close to the sun, which means that we can really help to understand how processes are happening on the sun as they spread out into space. We'll get two different measurement points. We'll be able to see how things are progressing as the solar wind moves away from the sun.
So tell me a bit about the Solar Orbiter mission. How close is it getting to the sun, and what are its particular aims?
So Solar Orbiter is going to go to 0.28 AU, so that's 28% of the Sun-Earth distance. It's just inside the orbit of Mercury. So the Parker Solar Probe will go much closer. It goes to about 0.04 AU, so 4% of the solar distance. But the key thing for Solar Orbiter is that because we're that little bit further out and the thermal stresses are slightly lower, that means that we were able to take a suite of not only in situ measurements, which measure the properties of the solar wind, like the magnetic field and the energetic particles and the particle energies and their distributions, but also where we can take a suite of cameras. So we will have telescopes that are looking at the sun in the ultraviolet, and also x-rays, and a whole suite of telescopes, as well as the kind of in situ measurements.
We'll come back to Helen a little later on when we look at some of the engineering challenges associated with the ESA's solar orbiter mission, including battling magnetic fields as well as thermal concerns. Absolutely nothing. The latter of these becomes especially prominent for the Parker Solar Probe, which will, like Icarus, be flying much closer to the sun. It's something scientists hope to combat using a heat shield.
You have a huge heat shield on the front of this spacecraft, and all the instruments sort of hide behind it. What is that shield made from, and how do you test its resilience to such temperatures here on Earth?
So a couple of answers to that one. So first of all, the material of the heat shield itself is a newly developed composite, and it was developed for this mission. So NASA, in the mid-2000s, NASA gave the Applied Physics Lab some technology money to actually come up with a material that would do this. And so we worked in partnership with Johns Hopkins University and came up with it's very simple, and people are always disappointed when I say it's made of carbon, because it's a carbon-carbon composite, and it's basically two very thin phase sheets, or very thin, you know, sheets of this composite with a carbon-carbon foam in the center, which is, I believe I'm right in saying, it's about 99% air. And then there's an alumina covering on the front side, which helps to reflect a lot of the light and heat coming from the sun. So it's made of carbon.
It sounds a bit flimsy. I mean, is it quite sturdy?
Oh, it's very sturdy. I mean, obviously you don't want to handle it too much. So we treat our heat shield with a great deal of respect, because we love our heat shield. it's the most important part of the mission, actually.
What sort of instruments do you have on board the Parker Solar Probe? Because behind this heat shield, that's where they're going to be lurking, is that right?
Most of them are, yes. And so we sort of joke that they ride in the lap of luxury, because they are behind the heat shield, and so they're in the shadow of the heat shield. And it's amazing to me that the front side of the heat shield can be at this, it's at 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And the instruments are working in room temperature. So just like you are sitting right now, the instruments are working in that. And, you know, it's always mind-blowing to me that the heat shield can be that effective just because it's in the shadow. But, of course, in space, there's no convection, and things like, you know, if you're sitting under an umbrella on a beach, convection is bringing heat up from the sand and all the other kind of stuff. So even though you're in the shade, you're still pretty warm. But in space, there is none of this convection or anything else going on. So you really, truly are sitting in the coldness of space. But we do have a couple of brave little instruments that stick out from behind the heat shield, because they need to make measurements of the environment itself. And so we have some electric field antenna. There are four of them, and they are attached on sort of four corners, if you like, of the heat shield. And they are out, and they are measuring not just the electric fields, but they're also measuring all the very small scale waves, a bit like radio waves, but plasma waves that we see in the solar wind. And we need them to be out and away from the body of the spacecraft. Otherwise, effectively, they'll just measure what's on the spacecraft.
Among these instruments is a collector that will scoop up particles from within the solar wind itself, as well as other high-energy particles.
We term it the bulk solar wind. So it's the kind of the most prominent particles in the solar wind. And they tend to be sort of at a lower energy, and they move with the solar wind. But they're basically what it's made up of. And so they're very important, because you need to characterize everything about the solar wind. You need to know the temperature, the density, the speeds, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so the devil is always in the details. And so, again, that's why we're going so close. We want to be measuring things as they're first happening, not as they've kind of averaged out and smoothed out 92 million miles away. And so, you know, we have all these measurements. We also have a full set of instruments that are beginning looking at the magnetic fields. The magnetic fields are very, very important to us. In this region where the acceleration occurs, not only does the plasma itself, you know, wave bye-bye to the sun and move out really, really fast, it actually carries the sun's magnetic field out with it. And so when the solar wind is impacting the Earth, sometimes the magnetic field it's carrying is in the opposite direction to our Earth's magnetic field. And just like everybody learned in science at school, like poles repel, opposites attract. So if the fields are in the different directions, they can actually connect and let all the energy in from the solar wind. So we really need to understand how the magnetic fields are governed, because it will help us better predict what is going to actually impact the Earth. And our final instrument is our imager. It's a white light imager, and it's not going to be taking pictures of the sun as, you know, we're used to seeing fantastic images from, you know, Solar Dynamics Observatory, etc. It's going to be taking pictures of what we're about to fly through. So it is truly going to be imaging the solar wind itself and seeing these structures and seeing these things that we don't even know they're there. It will be imaging those for us as we're moving in and out of the sun's neighborhood.
With the Solar Orbiter mission also taking a similar array of measurements, the hope is that our picture of the sun and its wind will become clearer than ever before. And after this short break, we'll hear why that's such a beguiling endeavor.
The desire to understand the sun has been something that, you know, mankind has been wondering about for thousands of years. It's so close and it's so important to us, the sun, but also it's so explosive and it's so unpredictable and it's so potentially damaging.
We'll also hear what it's like to be at the helm of one of these missions.
So this is a pretty nail-biting mission all the way through, actually. Having lived through a previous launch, I can tell you, you know, your first panic is actually getting it off the pad.
We'll be right back.
Create a beautiful website with Squarespace's all-in-one platform. There's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade, ever. Head to squarespace.com and enter the offer code GuardianScience to get 10% off your first purchase. Squarespace. Make your next move. Make your next website.
Before we kick off again, we want to recommend another of our podcasts here at The Guardian. It's called Football Weekly, and sees James Richardson and the Football Weekly pod squad bring you a twice-weekly dose of puns and punditry from the Premier League and beyond throughout the 2016-17 season. Football has never sounded this good. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcast or search Football Weekly on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard about two separate missions to send spacecraft to probe the sun's solar wind. We heard from Helen O'Brien, a lead engineer of an instrument aboard the ESA's Solar Orbiter mission, which will examine the sun's magnetic field, as well as collecting other data. We also heard from Dr. Nikki Fox, the project scientist of the second of these spacecraft missions, NASA's Parker Solar Probe. Along with telling us about this mission's objectives, Nikki explained how many of the probe's instruments will be protected by a heat shield, and so will be sitting in the so-called lap of luxury. As Nikki explains, the same cannot be said for the probe's guiding solar panels. But how does the team hope to stop these from melting?
You're absolutely right. How do you stop a solar panel from melting? So first of all, the solar wings themselves are kind of like on shoulder joints. So they can come out and stick all the way out sort of at 90 degrees from the spacecraft. And they can also sort of rotate like you would rotate your arm. So they can get maximum solar panel when we're far away from the sun. As we get closer and closer, those shoulder joints pull in the solar panels until literally just the fingertips are sticking out. And the fingertips at our closest approach to the sun produce the same amount of power as the entire wing does around the Earth. And so first of all, we protect them by pulling them into the shadow. And then the second thing we do is we call it actively cooling them. So in the same way that your hand has veins in it that carries blood all around there, we have effectively veins in the solar panels that carry water. That was the second largest technology development on the spacecraft after the heat shield itself.
And why go in these orbits around the sun? I mean, in a way, why not just go straight there, get into the close orbit, and you're done? Why take this time to get closer and closer?
Because we actually do want to get to, you know, around 10 solar radii away from the sun. So that's just under 4 million miles. And that's getting into the region where all this interesting stuff happens, you know, where the solar wind suddenly takes off and leaves and moves away. So we really do want to get into this region where these processes are occurring. The reason it takes so long is, again, in order to cut mission cost and to not require nuclear fuel, etc., we're doing continual flybys of the planet Venus. So when we first launch, 8 weeks after we leave Florida, we actually encounter Venus for the first time. And many people are used to planetary flybys being to increase your speed. New Horizons, for example, did a big gravity assist around Jupiter and then, you know, took off at a much faster speed and got to Pluto quicker than if we hadn't done this gravity assist. So people are used to that kind of thing. We're actually doing the opposite. I always joke that we're very generous and we're giving to the planet as opposed to taking away. But we actually use it to slow down just a little bit. And it basically trims our orbit and allows us to hit our solar orbit targets precisely every time. So we do that 7 times. And on each of those flybys, it brings us, we say, you know, we gracefully walk in closer to the sun, but, you know, it's effectively just brings us closer and closer until we get to less than 10 solar radii from the surface.
But regardless of this balletic approach, the conditions these instruments will have to work in poses a whole array of engineering challenges.
So, as you said, you're lead engineer for one of the instruments on the solar orbiter. How difficult is it to build an instrument that gets this close to the sun?
Helen O'Brien again.
It's tricky. It really is. And I have been working on this project for 10 years. So the first technical proposal I put in was way back in 2007. And over time, the spacecraft has evolved and the instrument has evolved. And the key problems that we've had is that we are a magnetic field instrument. So we measure the magnetic field in situ where the spacecraft is. Now, obviously, a huge issue with any kind of magnetic field measurement is that the spacecraft gives off a magnetic field. Any electric current anywhere will generate a magnetic field. So we don't want to just measure the magnetic field of the spacecraft. We want to measure the magnetic field of the space where we are. And if you think about where we are on the Earth's surface, the unit that we use to measure magnetic field is the Tesla. And on the Earth's surface, it's about 50,000 nanotesla. And we want to measure fields that are around 10 nanotesla. So this is the solar wind field. This is the sun's magnetic field. So they're very small magnetic fields. And you can imagine that a spacecraft actually gives off quite a big magnetic field. So in order to try and reduce the interference we get from the spacecraft, we put our instrument out on a boom a long distance away from the spacecraft. So we just use physical separation. We've also been involved with a huge magnetic cleanliness program, it's called. So it's the way that you try to make the magnetic signature of the spacecraft really small. And that's been a program that all 10 instruments have had to buy into, and a program that the European Space Agency has bought into in a big way, and the prime that build the spacecraft. So we've been working very intensely with them to try and make sure that the magnetic signature of the spacecraft is small enough that we can still work out what the real field is. And the other challenge that we've had is that even though we're going really close to the sun, which you would think would mean we get really hot, because we're out on a boom stretched out behind the spacecraft in, you know, kind of radiating to deep space in all directions, it actually gets really cold. So we're having to deal with temperatures around minus 100 degrees, which is a bit of a challenge as well for us, because thermally we have to be able to survive those temperatures and we have to be able to maintain our alignment in those temperatures while we're testing, you know, on the Earth's surface with a big field and obviously the room temperature that is usual.
I was going to ask that, how difficult, I mean, how much do you have to try to recreate those conditions
here on Earth in order to test these instruments? And how hard is that?
You absolutely have to. So one of the key things that you have to demonstrate before any space agency will let you put any instrument on a spacecraft is that it's qualified. So it is able to cope with the environment that it will see. So here at Imperial College, we have a low field, low temperature facility. So we can cool our sensors down using liquid nitrogen. We cool them down to minus 100, minus 120. And we put them in a magnetic shield. So we have a shield that means that the field inside the shield is of the same order as the solar wind field, so a few tens of nanotesla. So we have a special facility here that can do that. But obviously, being in the centre of London, it's not a particularly magnetically quiet environment. So we can see lifts going up and down in the building. We know, you know, what the trains are doing or if big trucks are driving past on the street. So we also calibrate the instrument at a very, very quiet magnetic facility in Germany, which is basically in the middle of a forest in the middle of nowhere.
Challenges aside, both Helen and Nikki are confident that their various probes and instruments will withstand the problems posed by our sun. But assuming all goes to plan, how long will it be before we begin to get data back?
So we launch July 31st, 2018. We're on a
Nikki
Delta
Fox again.
Heavy, which is the huge, huge launch vehicle. We also have a third stage to make sure that we're moving as fast as possible when we leave. 8 weeks after that, we will encounter the planet Venus. Just 8 weeks after that, we are in our closest approach to the sun for the first time. You know, we'll be getting data, critical data, in, you know, just over 3 months after the launch. Because of orbital dynamics and that large glowing body that is often between us and the probe, we won't get data immediately. We have to wait, for the probe to come around, and then we can downlink the data. So we should be seeing fantastic data 7 months after launch for the first big data dump will be.
What's the most nerve-wracking part of the mission for you? Is it the takeoff? Is it getting into orbit? Is it those first attempts to get at the data? What is it that's going to have you biting your nails on this?
So this is a pretty nail-biting mission all the way through, actually. Having lived through a previous launch, I can tell you, you know, your first panic is actually getting it off the pad. Then the next one is, you know, knowing that all the separation and everything's taken place. Then you need to make sure that the solar panels have deployed and you're actually, we say power positive, but, you know, you're actually able to generate power on the spacecraft. Then, you know, you start deploying instruments, you start bringing on the subsystems, and every single one of those is nerve-wracking, because if they don't work, you have a major issue. And it's, you know, you can't just pop down to, you know, the local DIY store and get a part and go fix it. It's gone. So, you know, there's nothing you can really do about it. So assuming that all that goes fine and we fly past Venus and that's all perfect, I think the first closest approach is going to be the big one for me. You know, knowing that we've got through it, the instruments are all working, and even though we can't see the high resolution data, we'll obviously know that the instruments have taken data. We'll be able to see that, you know, our solid state recorder is full of data, and we'll know that it's not zeros. So, you know, we'll know that's good. I think once we've made that first perihelia pass and we're on our way into the second one, I think I may probably start to take the occasional nap.
With the ESA's Solar Orbiter satellite expected to launch in October the same year, the hope is that by the end of the two missions, we might be one step closer to understanding the mysteries of the sun's magnetic field and its solar wind. But why do we care?
So there are a couple of different things. I mean, I think just the voyage of discovery, you know, everybody deep in their heart wants to be an explorer. And I think that, you know, when you kind of ride along on the back of one of these NASA missions that is going somewhere we've never been before, I just think the excitement of, golly, this is like, you know, going to a new country. We're going to a new region of the solar system. And this really is the last major region of the solar system to be discovered and to be explored. And, you know, I'm biased. I would say it's the most important part of the solar system. But it really is the part that is governing the way all the other planets kind of interact with the solar wind. So, you know, the other thing is that the sun, I hate to offend it, but we always describe it as an average star, even though it is the most important thing to us. It is, on the stellar spectrum, an average star. So, you know, when you understand what things occur in our own sun, it has immediate implications for what happens on other stars that are very like our sun. So we know that, you know, that there are stellar winds, we call ours the solar wind, but other stars that will have stellar winds, and we'll be able to understand more and predict more about what those far away stars are actually doing. And to me, that's amazing.
The desire to understand the sun has been something that, you know, mankind has been wondering about for thousands of years. It's so close and it's so important to us, the sun, but also it's so explosive and it's so unpredictable and it's so potentially damaging. So the desire to understand it is both because it's fascinating, but also because it is a bit scary. And the more that we rely on satellites in our lives, the more we have to appreciate that the sun can make life very difficult for us at times, with particularly large explosions, solar flares that can destroy satellites and can destroy our kind of new communication structure.
Special thanks this week to Dr. Nikki Fox and Helen O'Brien. We'll include a link to my article on the Parker Solar Probe mission in the episode's description on the Guardian website. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.